Sie haben eine politische Alternative skizziert. Das Merkwürdige ist, dass in Europa kein Politiker von links bis rechts für diese Alternative kämpfen würde. In Europa scheint von links bis rechts Einigkeit zu bestehen. Es gibt nur diesen einen Weg des Sparens. Wie erklären Sie sich das?
You just outlined a possible alternative to what we see right now in Europe. What's strange is that among politicians you don't find anyone from left to right in Europe right now who would fight for such an alternative. It seems to be common sense from left to right that there is no alternative to what we do now. How do you explain this?
That's a very difficult thing to explain. But I think that you're right that the grip of this idea, which may have its roots in perhaps in Protestant theology, is that the sinner must reform or be punished. There's a confusion, I think it's an easy confusion to make, between a surplus position and virtue and a deficit position and vice. It's an easy position to explain, and it reinforces the feelings of self-worth amongst those people who consider themselves to be hardworking and successful, who are in the countries that have been producing strong industries and have been producing goods for export, earning surpluses from the others. This is it's a pernicious idea from an economic point of view, but it meshes very well with people's deepest sense of values and with the ideas that politicians can both express and profit from because they gain the support of people who feel that way. And that's true, I think, across it's the left and the right. It's very hard for a simple economist looking at this from the standpoint of balance sheets and of accounting relationships, necessary accounting relationships, to say, no, look, you who have the surpluses, you're not harder working than the people who have the deficits. It's actually the case that Greeks work more hours than any other people in Europe, and they do so for substantially lower wages. So it's not the case that one group is working harder than the other. One group is more virtuous. The other group is a group of lazy slackers who are enjoying their time in the sun. This is a false image. It's an image which is easy to foster in a particular community, but it's wrong. It's the case that the two communities are the mirror images of each other. The surpluses of one and the deficits of the other are both, one is necessary for the other to exist. And what one has to recognize is that this is an intrinsically unstable relationship, which certainly cannot be sustained on the terms of commercial lending. In other words, the deficit countries are not going to become surplus countries and able to pay back their loans out of the proceeds of their surpluses. Those surpluses don't exist, aren't going to exist. So periodically, if you do this, the loans have to be forgiven and written down, or the system has to be changed. It makes a great deal more sense to create a regular mechanism for recycling incomes than it is to go through these periodic financial crises. And that's really those are the only two alternatives if one country, let's say Germany, chooses to continue to pursue policies that produce surpluses.
Warum nicht ganz Europa zu einem großen Deutschland machen?
Why not make turn the whole of Europe into one big Germany?
It can't happen. What happens when you integrate a series of national economies or a series of regional economies into a single market is that economic activity tends to concentrate in the richest and most successful places. It's absolutely the case in the United States, where, for example, if you look at where the emergent technology industry is, I mean, it's deeply concentrated in Northern California, the suburbs of Boston, and a handful of other places. It is not spread out over the whole country. In order to even, and in Europe, even agriculture has moved to the north. I mean, you get lettuce being exported from Belgium. So this is an unavoidable standard process, reflecting technology, increasing returns, the location preferences of major firms. And the problem is that the rents from this concentration flow not to Europe as a whole, but to the particular country that happens to be where the advanced industries are. Now, the European community understood this when it established its rules and understood there would have to be compensating flows and development funds. That's what the structural funds are for. That's why they exist. But they are not adequate to the force of concentration that we have observed since the creation of the euro. And the same thing was true in the United States, as I said before. And up until the 1930s and even up until the 1960s, we established very powerful methods for supporting the economies of the non-competitive regions. And this included, in part, of course, defense spending, but mainly Social Security, Medicare, the expenditure on retirement, on health care, the minimum wage, which supports wages in the parts of the country where wages would otherwise be very low. Doesn't do anything in New York, but it's very important in Texas. These things all have the effect of maintaining a kind of balance, a decentralization of economic activity. If you want to have sustainable decentralized activity, you have to support it by having substantial income transfers from the center to the periphery. Otherwise, it won't happen.
Was wir vielleicht schon dieses Wochenende sehen werden, ist, dass die Europäische Zentralbank tatsächlich stärker intervenieren wird. Findet der Euro damit einen Weg aus der Krise?
What we will probably see, maybe already this weekend, is that the European Central Bank will intervene in a much more aggressive way. Is this the way out for the Eurozone?
It's certainly a step to diffuse, if it were done fully and effectively, it would be a step to diffuse the funding issues which are resulting in these unsustainably high interest rates for Italy and other countries. And one of the interesting situations here, I do believe you're right that the European Central Bank, when it looks at its options in a sensible way, will decide that it basically has to fund Italy because Italy is 20% of the Eurozone economy. And its debt, or I guess its debt is 20% of Eurozone GDP. It's a vast economy. And the Italians have the leverage to force a change in European policy if they had a government that was willing to use that leverage. They are much more significant than the Greeks or the Portuguese or even the Spaniards, although Spain is obviously also a very important place. So the Italians are in the position similar to what the Americans are with the Chinese, a country which can chart its own course if it wishes to. And that's, I think, a very important fact potentially, but it would require for that potential to be realized for the Italian position to be expressed and the Italian national interest to be expressed effectively in the councils of Europe, which, of course, obviously was not true under the previous Italian government and probably will not be true under the current one, which, although very different, is not an independent voice.
Kommen nochmal zurück auf die Frage der politischen Machbarkeit Ihrer Alternative. Was wir sehen, ist, glaube ich, dass der Euro nicht nur eine finanzielle Zwangsjacke ist für die Länder des Südens, sondern auch eine politische Zwangsjacke, sonst würden diese Alternativen dort doch vorgetragen und dafür gekämpft.
I come back to the feasibility of your alternative macroeconomic way of solving the crisis. What we see now, I think, is that the euro is not only a financial straitjacket for the countries in the south, but also a political straitjacket. That seems to be the problem. Otherwise, some parties there might come up and with these alternative ideas of how to save the Eurozone.
Well, that is indeed part of the situation. It was obviously very difficult for the government of Mr. Papandreou, which was a seriously reforming government. I knew quite a few of the ministers in that government, a government with a very strong basis in the United States. Many of its ministers were American trained. The prime minister, of course, was born and raised in the United States. It was very hard for that government, a socialist government, to be taken seriously as a true partner in the European project. But that doesn't mean that the countries of Southern Europe can easily escape from the fetters of the euro. You know, one interesting possibility is that the decision to leave might be taken by Germany. And that would have, I'm not saying that's likely, I don't think it is, but it would have the interesting property that the debts in euro, the euro would become the depreciating currency, and that would certainly make things easier. But I continue to think that from a technical standpoint, the easiest way out is to change the policies within the existing institutions of the Eurozone. The Eurobonds proposal through the European Central Bank, combined with investment projects from the European Investment Bank, combined with a resolution of the banking issues using European Financial Stability Fund, perhaps, as a new European bank regulator, was the essence of a proposal which has fairly wide backing in European, in at least some former European leadership circles. And it would come back to the basic phenomenon that we touched on at the beginning of our talk, which is that this issue is a banking crisis. And putting things on a sustainable footing does mean addressing the problem of the over-leveraging of the banks and of the fallen value of their assets, both assets that they acquired from the United States and the European sovereign debts that they hold. Probably means that the fundamentally, from a political standpoint, the standpoint of political economy, the right way forward is to restructure the European banking system and put it under a single European regulator that would provide an appropriate supervision, which has obviously been lacking.
I'll ask you one last question and then we'll make a full stop. Sie haben ja alles das als im Prinzip wirtschaftswissenschaftliche Lehrbuchweisheit erklärt. In Europa gibt es viele Kollegen, die sind anderer Meinung. Was sagen Sie denn denen? Und die beraten ja offensichtlich Leute wie Merkel und Sarkozy. Haben die einfach merkwürdige Ideen oder was ist mit denen los?
You presented me your ideas basically as every scientist does, or as every economist does, as a simple macroeconomic textbook wisdom. But we know you have some colleagues here in Europe who really have completely different views of the situation, and apparently those people are the ones that are in talks with the likes of Angela Merkel and Nicolas Sarkozy. What about those colleagues? Are they simply on our wrong track, or is this an interesting scientific debate?
It's not an interesting scientific debate, in my view. I don't think that the foundations of the argument I've been making here are contestable, or that they are seriously contested. The reality is that the accounting relationships between surplus and deficit countries, which are at the root of this, are well known, easily established, demonstrable in the data, and irrefutable. I recently organized a conference in Austin, Texas, on the crisis in the Eurozone with two participants from Germany, one of them Heiner Flasbeck of UNCTAD in Geneva, and the other one a professor teaching in the United States named Jörg Biebel. The two presentations were very similar, and they both relied very heavily on these accounting identities. So there may be people who believe that you can have a balance sheet that has only assets and no liabilities, that you can have surplus in everywhere and deficits nowhere. But those people are what in medical parlance would be described as quacks. They are people whose expertise is a false expertise, and they are catering to political leaders who find their views perhaps convenient, perhaps profitable from a political point of view, but they're doing a very profound disservice to their broader populations and to the future of the European Union, because you cannot effectively run a large, complex political entity in defiance of these basic realities unless you are prepared to accept vast costs that are going to be inflicted on very vulnerable people. So I think one basically has to infer, since I actually doubt that my colleagues that you refer to are completely unaware of these things as your question implied. I think the reality is that they are aware, but that the fate of the welfare state, the fate of education systems and healthcare systems, and retirement support, and the living standards in the peripheral countries is not something that they're concerned about. In fact, they have drawn the conclusion that living standards in those countries should be slashed, and that this project of European convergence and common welfare is not the project that they are pursuing.
So no scientific issue there, but a political issue between left and right, and the right is using this crisis in order to roll back the welfare state.
Yes, I think that's the most reasonable inference, yes. Otherwise, you have to treat your adversaries as being, I think, much less able than they in fact are.